Last fall term, a group of interested students and faculty members met to discuss the possibility of a Michigan State summer educational project. From that time until today, the students of Michigan State University have recognized the need for their active participation in something more than that which the college students of today typically involve themselves. The student education program is educational rather than political in nature, stressing our social obligations and appealing to the new idealism of our generation. In order to begin such a program, we felt it necessary to bring to this campus a man who represents this idealism, a man whose leadership has proven invaluable in the civil rights movement, a man who has been called by many the Gandhi of America, a man who, after becoming the youngest ever to win the Nobel Prize, announced, "I do not consider this merely an honor to me personally, but a tribute to the discipline, wise restraint, and majestic courage of the millions of gallant Negroes and white persons of goodwill who have followed a nonviolent course in seeking to establish a reign of justice and rule of love across this nation of ours. As president of all university student government, it gives me great privilege to present to you the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, 1963 Man of the Year, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King."
Mr. Harris, members of the faculty and members of the student body of this great institution of learning, ladies and gentlemen, I need not pause to say how very delighted I am to be here this afternoon and to be able to be on this very significant platform. And I want to express my deep personal appreciation to the officers and members of the All University Student Government for extending the invitation. It is always a rich and rewarding experience for me when I can take a brief break from the day-to-day demands of our struggle for justice and human dignity in the South to discuss the issues involved in that struggle with college and university students and concerned individuals over this nation and over the world. And so I can assure you that it is a real privilege and pleasure to be here today. I would also like to publicly commend the All University Student Government for initiating this very significant summer educational project to take place at Rust College in Holly Springs, Mississippi. And this is a great expression of your humanitarian concern. And I know that it will go a long, long way to give new hope and new encouragement to the people of Mississippi who have struggled so long to get into the mainstream of American life. And this project reveals to us that The student generation of today is not an apathetic generation, but there are many, many students who are revealing every day that this is a concerned generation of students, concerned with the social, political, and economic problems that we face in our nation and over the world. And I know that this program, or this project, will have the absolute support of the faculty members and the students of this great university, and the support that it needs so much. I want to talk this afternoon about some of the problems we are facing in our world today and in our own nation by using as a subject from which to speak facing the challenge of a new age. Facing the challenge of a new age. Victor Hugo said on one occasion that there is nothing more powerful in all the world than an idea whose time has come. And in a real sense, the idea whose time has come today is the idea of freedom and human dignity. Wherever men are assembled, the cry is always the same: we want to be free. And so the wind of change is blowing in our nation, the wind of change is blowing all over the world. It is sweeping away an old and unjust order and bringing into being a new order. Now, we have seen the old order on the international scale in the form of colonialism. But over the last few years, we have witnessed the gradual demise of the whole system of colonialism. We have seen the old order in the United States in the form of slavery and racial segregation. But here again, we have seen slavery pass away. And we are seeing today the gradual demise of the whole system of racial segregation. And so, in a real sense, the old order of colonialism and racial segregation is passing away, and the new order of political independence and racial integration is coming into being. Now, whenever anything new comes into history, it brings with it new responsibilities and new challenges. And I would like to discuss this afternoon some of the challenges that we face all over the world in general and in our nation in particular as a result of this emerging new age. And first, I would like to say that we are challenged to achieve a world perspective. The world in which we live is geographically one. And now more than ever before, we are challenged to go all out to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now it is true that the geographical oneness of our age has come into being to a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took months and weeks. I think Bob Hope has adequately described this jet age in which we live, and I know it isn't the usual thing for a Baptist preacher to be quoting Bob Hope, but I think he's adequately described this jet age in which we live. He said it is an age in which it is possible to take a non-stop flight from Los Angeles, California to New York City. And if on taking off in Los Angeles you develop hiccups, you will hick in Los Angeles and cup in New York City. You know, it is true, because of the time difference, that it is possible to take a jet flight from Tokyo, Japan on Sunday morning and arrive in Seattle, Washington on the preceding Saturday night. And when your friends meet you at the airport and ask when you left Tokyo, you will have to say, "I left tomorrow." Now, this is a bit humorous, but I'm trying to laugh a basic fact into all of us. And it is simply this, that through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood. And now, through our moral and ethical commitment, we must make of it a brotherhood. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools. This is a great challenge of the hour. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. I remember some few years ago that Mrs. King and I had the great privilege of journeying to that great nation known as India. And I never will forget the experience that we had there, the experience of meeting and talking with the great leaders of India, and meeting and talking with hundreds and thousands of people all over the cities and villages of that vast country. And these experiences will remain dear to me as long as the cords of memory shall lengthen. But I must say to you this afternoon that there were those depressing moments. But how can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes evidences of millions of people going to bed hungry at night? How can one avoid being depressed when he sees with his own eyes millions of people sleeping on the sidewalks at night? They have no houses to go in. They have no beds to sleep in. More than a million people sleep on the sidewalks of Bombay every night. More than 600,000 sleep on the sidewalks of Calcutta every night. How can one avoid being depressed when he discovers that out of India's population, more than 420 million people, some 390 million make an annual income of less than $80 a year, and most of these people have never seen a doctor or a dentist. And as I observed these conditions, something within me cried out, "Can we in America stand idly by and not be concerned?" And an answer came, "Oh no, because the destiny of the United States is tied up with the destiny of India and every other nation." And I started thinking of the fact that in our country, we spend millions of dollars a day to store surplus food. And I said to myself, I know where we can store that food free of charge, in the wrinkled stomachs of the millions of God's children in Asia and Africa and South America and in our own nation who go to bed hungry at night. And it may well be that we have spent far too much of our national budget establishing military bases around the world, rather than bases of genuine concern and understanding. All I'm saying is simply this, that all life is interrelated. And we all somehow caught in an inescapable network of mutuality tied in a single garment of destiny. And whatever affects one directly, it affects all indirectly. For some strange reason, I can never be what I ought to be until you are what you ought to be, and you can never be what you ought to be until I am what I ought to be. This is the interrelated structure of reality. John Donne caught it years ago and placed it in graphic terms. No man is an island entire of itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. And then he goes on toward the end to say, any man's death diminishes me because I am involved in mankind. Therefore, never sin to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee. And I think this is the first great challenge that we face in the world today as a result of this emerging new age. Now, the second thing that I would like to point out is that we are challenged more than ever before to get rid of the notion once and for all that there are superior and inferior races. Now, in certain situations, this idea still lingers around. Now, it is true that great academic resources and persons in many of our academic disciplines have pointed out that there is no truth in this idea. Great anthropologists like Ruth Benedict, Margaret Mead, the late Melvin Herskovitz, and others have made it clear over and over again that as a result of long years of study, they see no evidence for the idea that there are superior and inferior races. There may be superior and inferior individuals academically or intellectually in all races, but that is no truth in the idea of superior and inferior races. And yet this notion still lingers around. And a great deal of the doctrine of white supremacy emerged out of this idea of superior and inferior races. Now, there was a time that people tried to argue the validity of this idea on the basis of religion and the Bible. It's strange indeed how people will use or misuse religion and the Bible to justify their prejudices. But this so often happens. And so it was argued at one time that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. And then somebody quoted the Apostle Paul's dictum, and it almost became a watchword, "Servants, be obedient to your master." And then one brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle. You know, Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we now know as formal logic in philosophy. And formal logic has a big word called the syllogism, which has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother decided to put his argument of the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He came out with his major premise, all men are made in the image of God. Then came his minor premise, God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro, therefore the Negro is not a man. This was the kind of reasoning that prevailed. This was the reasoning that prevailed in so many circles. Now, by and large, people have gotten away from the idea of using the Bible and religion to justify slavery and segregation, not totally away from it, but on the whole, I think we moved away from it. Of course, I did read the other day where one of our white brothers in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. But I think on the whole, we've gotten away from these notions. Now the arguments are placed on more subtle sociological and cultural grounds. The Negro is not culturally ready for integration, some would argue. If you integrate the schools and other areas of life, you will pull the white race back a generation. And you see, the Negro is a criminal. He has the highest crime rate in any city. And so these arguments go on ad infinitum. The individuals who set forth these arguments never go on to say that if there are lagging standards in the Negro community, and there certainly are, they are there because of the legacy of slavery and segregation. Criminal responses are environmental and not racial. Poverty, ignorance, disease, economic deprivation, social isolation, breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. It is necessary to go back and grapple with the causal source. And so it is absolutely urgent for us to get rid of the notion once and for all that there are superior and inferior races. For that is no truth in this idea, and brotherhood will never be a reality until we totally reveal the falsity of this idea which has been circulated so long. There are too many examples within the Negro community and with other within other minority groups to reveal that there is no truth in this idea. And so many individuals who have had to walk through the long and desolate night of oppression have over and over again risen up to plunge against cloud-filled nights of affliction, new and blazing stars of inspiration, thereby justifying the conviction of the poet, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claims. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in white and black the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole, or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. And so we are challenged today to get rid of the notion of superior and inferior races. And now let me get more to the problem which we face here in our own country on a day-to-day basis. We are challenged to work with determination and zeal by developing massive action programs to get rid of all of the vestiges of segregation and discrimination which still remain in our country. It is necessary to realize that this problem will not work itself out. We must have massive action programs. Now, in order to engage in an action program, we've got to get rid of one or two false ideas that are disseminated over and over again. One or two myths that are disseminated in our country, and as long as they are there, we cannot move out into the realm of constructive action. First is the myth of time. You have heard this over and over again, I'm sure. It is the notion that only time can solve the problem which we face in race relations in the United States. It is a notion that time is the only solution because somehow you've got to change men within. And so the individuals who believe in this idea would say to the Negro and his allies in the white community, just be nice and patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years the problem will work itself out, because time is the only solution. Well, I think that is an answer to the myth of time, and it is simply this, that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I'm absolutely convinced that the forces of ill will in our nation have so often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And it may well be that we will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people who will bomb a church in Birmingham, Alabama, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around and say, wait on time. Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive and insurgent forces of irrational emotionalism and social stagnation. So it is necessary for us to help time and to realize that the time is always ripe to do right. Now the second false notion, the second myth that is constantly disseminated is the idea that legislation has no place in this problem and in solving this problem. It is a notion that legislation cannot really work in this area because it can't change the heart. And there again, we hear this all over, and we hear it from a number of individuals who are probably very sincere. They feel that legislation really can't solve the problem. Now, it may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law cannot change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law can't make a man love me, but it can restrain him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important also. It may be true that the law cannot change the hearts of men, but it does change the habits of men. And when you change the habits of men, pretty soon the attitudes will be changed and the hearts will be changed. And so it is urgent to see the necessity of civil rights legislation over and over again to grapple with the problems that we still face. If we are going to have a massive action program, we must see the necessity for constructive legislation. In every community in this country, almost, we have a housing problem. Negroes confront glaring discrimination and glaring segregation in the realm of housing. Brotherhood will never be a reality in America until men and women learn to live together in integrated housing situations. And I think legislation has a role to play there. I think every state should go all out to get legislation to make open occupancy a real factor and a basic bill so that we can move ahead in housing integration. Also, we have problems in the area of jobs. FEPC is very important. We need it in every state. We need it on the federal level even more than we presently have in the present Civil Rights Bill, which was passed in 1964. The Negro is still at the bottom of the economic ladder. The Negro still finds himself perishing on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. And a healthy nation will do something about this problem. If we will look at the situation, we will notice that 42% of the Negro families of our country still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 17% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 21% of the Negro families of America earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. 88% of the Negro families earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. And we see this gulf getting even wider. We see the problem compounded today because of automation and cybernation. For years, a Negro has been limited by and large to semi-skilled and unskilled labor. As a result of many years of exploitation and domination, as a result of inadequate educational opportunities, as a result of a lack of apprenticeship training and discrimination in this area, and the disease jobs that are now passing away, these unskilled and semi-skilled jobs. And so the Negro finds himself so often in a city like Detroit, for instance, 28% of the population and almost 72% of the unemployed. And this is duplicated in every major urban community of our country. Now that is a need for massive retraining programs, a need for massive action programs, a need for massive public works programs, in order to deal with this problem, which is a great and difficult problem. That is nothing more dangerous in any community or any nation than to build up a society which has a segment of individuals in that society who feel that they have no stake in that society, who feel that they have nothing to lose. These are the individuals who, in the midst of pleas for nonviolence, will begin to riot. These are the individuals who feel such a sense of hopelessness and despair that they will somehow turn to antisocial behavior in order to get attention. And so a healthy nation will seek to develop a society where all men will feel that they are participants in the mainstream of that society, and where they will feel that they have a stake in that society. And so the problem of making jobs available for all people is a very basic problem in our nation and one that all people of goodwill should set out to deal with. And this, it seems to me, requires a massive action program. Let me also mention the right to vote. This is one of the great problems that we still confront in some areas of the Deep South. And I think every American should rise up with righteous indignation when any individual in our country is denied the right to vote. We know that in states like Mississippi, Negroes often face death when they seek to vote. Negroes face economic reprisals when they seek to vote. They face complex literacy tests with questions so involved that a PhD in any field couldn't answer, or a person with a law degree from the great law universities or schools of our nation couldn't answer. And this is a problem also in Alabama. This is a situation that we are presently facing in Selma, Alabama, and Dallas County. Here you have 15,125 Negroes of voting age, and yet only 325 are registered. On the other hand, you have 14,000 whites of voting age, and more than 9,400 of them are registered. Negroes who seek to register in Selma have to answer questions so involved that Justice Earl Warren would find it difficult, if not impossible, to answer the complicated, absurd questions. And Negroes face arrest, intimidation, and harassment from sheriffs all across the South. And this is what Negroes are facing this very day in Selma, seeking to go down to the courthouse merely to register. And they are thrown in jail on all kinds of imaginary and absurd charges, contempt of court, contributing to the delinquency of a minor, disorderly conduct, and anything else that they can develop. Now, until our nation develops some legislation to deal with this, so that no state can engage in the misuse of the judicial process, no state can engage in the abuse of police power to block individuals from becoming registered voters, then and only then will we rise to the greatness of our nation. And so that is a need for new legislation to deal with this problem. Just last Monday, I talked with President Johnson and Vice President Humphrey and Attorney General Katzenbach about this problem. Made it clear that after working in Selma over these last few weeks, that I'm more convinced than ever before that the federal legislation that we presently have on this issue is inadequate, and that we need new federal legislation that will bring into being federal registrars. And this is asking for nothing new. The great president of this university, who has served in such a magnificent manner with the Civil Rights Commission, joined with that commission in making a recommendation years ago that there should be federal registrars after studying the patterns of discrimination all over the South in the area of voter registration. And so this is not asking for anything new. It is asking for only that which has been recommended by the Civil Rights Commission. And also that is a need to get rid of the dichotomy between federal patterns of registration and state patterns of registration. That is need for a uniform, universal pattern of voter registration so that a person won't have to pay poll tax on the state level and yet not have to pay it on the federal level. This has brought about a great deal of confusion within the five states where you still have poll tax in state elections while not having it in federal elections as a result of a recent constitutional amendment. And that is also need to do away with the literacy tests altogether. No state that has denied individuals adequate educational opportunities, no state that has perpetuated in a real sense the process of illiteracy should have the right to demand that its citizens have literacy in the sense that they talk about literacy in order to register and vote. And so something must be done to do away with the literacy test so that we can get people registered and not move at the snail's pace. I started working on it the other day through mathematical formulations and discovered that on the basis that they are presently registering Negroes in Selma, Alabama, it will take exactly 68 years to get two-thirds of the Negroes who are eligible to vote registered. Now, I studied the Mississippi rate. They registered 1,600 Negroes last year, a little more than 1,600. It means that it will take exactly 132 years to get half of the Negroes who are eligible to vote in Mississippi registered. Now, this is how slow they are moving in those states. And I think that all men of goodwill will rise up in this great moment of our history and in this great period of social change and make it clear that this cannot continue to exist in our nation. For the right to vote is a sacred, basic, constitutional right that every American must have. And in order to guarantee that right, I again repeat that it is necessary to have a massive action program. And let me say that all of this must be undergirded by a basic philosophy. The action program must be undergirded by a method and a philosophy. And so far, the civil rights movement has been undergirded by the philosophy of nonviolent resistance. Now, I would like to say just a few words about nonviolence, since it has been so basic in our struggle, since it has been the regulating ideal and the prevailing method. First, I would like to say that I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom and human dignity. That is powered in this approach. It has a way of disarming the opponent. It exposes his moral defenses. It weakens his morale, and at the same time, it works on his conscience. And he just doesn't know how to handle it. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you accept the quiet courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense loves to go to jail. But if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true, that they are worth dying for. And if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. And the nonviolent discipline instills something within the individual which causes him to stand up for justice and stand up for right without fear and without a violence within or a violence without. And that is power here, in that it has a way of disarming the opponent. That is another thing about nonviolence and its basic philosophy. It says that it is possible to struggle to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the great debates of history in philosophical circles has been over the whole question of ends and means. And there have been those who argued that the end justifies the means. Sometimes systems of government have argued this. But this is where nonviolence would break with these systems, or any system that would argue that the end justifies the means. Because in a real sense, the end is pre-existent in the means. The means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And in the long run of history, destructive methods cannot bring about constructive ends. Means and ends should cohere. And nonviolence says in substance that it is possible to struggle to secure the end of racial justice, the goal of integration, with the means of justice and the means of nonviolence, and the means that are pure and as pure as the end. That is another thing that is basic in the nonviolent philosophy when it is true to its basic precepts. That is, that it says that it is possible to struggle against an unjust system and yet not fall into the rut of hating the perpetrators of that unjust system. Now, this is, I guess, the most misunderstood aspect of the nonviolent philosophy, because people ask me over and over again, what do you mean when you say love those who are oppressing you? What are you talking about when you say love those who are seeking to destroy you and who are bombing your home and threatening your children? What do you mean when you say love such people? And I think it is a valid question, because when I talk about love in the area of racial justice and in the struggle for racial justice, I'm not talking about emotional bosh. I'm not talking about a sentimental, affectionate response. It would be nonsense to urge oppressed people to love their violent oppressors in an affectionate sense. So when I think of love at this point, I'm thinking of something much deeper. Fortunately, the Greek language comes to our rescue in trying to find the meaning of love in this context. There are three words in Greek for love. One is the word eros. Plato talks about eros a great deal in his dialogues, a yearning of the soul for the realm of the divine. To Plato, it was a sort of aesthetic love. It has come to us to be a sort of romantic love, and so in this sense, we all know about eros. We have experienced it, and we've read about it in all of the beauties of literature. In a sense, Edgar Allan Poe was talking about eros when he talked about his beautiful Annabel Lee with the love surrounded by the halo of eternity. In a sense, Shakespeare was even talking about eros when he said, love is not love which alters when it alteration finds or bends with the remover to remove. It is an ever-fixed mark that looks at tempest and is never shaken. It is a star to every wandering bark. You know, I can remember that because I used to quote it to my wife when we were courting. That's eros. And then the Greek language talks about phileo, which is another level of love. It is a sort of intimate affection between personal friends on this level. You love because you are loved. You love people that you like. This is friendship. Then the Greek language comes out with another word. It is the word agape. Agape is more than eros. Agape is more than aesthetic or romantic love. Agape is more than friendship. Agape is creative, understanding, redemptive goodwill for all men. It is an overflowing love which seeks nothing in return. Theologians would say that it is the love of God operating in the human heart. And when one rises to love on this level, he loves every man. When one rises to love on this level, he loves the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. When one rises to love on this level, he rises to the point of having a sort of demanding love, a love that demands justice, a love that demands brotherhood. He rises to the point of realizing that he is his brother's keeper, and that while he at times will have to engage in a boycott, while he will have to engage in massive demonstrations, while he will have to engage in all nonviolent means to bring about the end of a just society, he is doing it not to defeat or to humiliate the opponent, but to win his friendship and understanding, and to bring about true reconciliation, and to create the beloved community. And I believe it is this kind of love that can lead us out of a dark yesterday into a bright tomorrow. And so in our best moments, when we have been true to nonviolence at its best, we have been able to stand up before our most violent opponents and say in substance, we will match your capacity to inflict suffering by our capacity to endure suffering. We will meet your physical force with soul force. Do to us what you will, and we will still love you. We cannot in all good conscience obey your unjust laws, because non-cooperation with evil is as much a moral obligation as is cooperation with good. And so throw us in jail, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Bomb our homes and threaten our children, and as difficult as it is, we will still love you. Yes, send your hooded perpetrators of violence into our communities at the midnight hours and drag us out on some wayside road and beat us and leave us half dead. And as difficult as it is, we will still love you. But be ye assured that we will wear you down by our capacity to suffer, and one day we will win our freedom. But we will not only win freedom for ourselves, we will so appeal to your heart and your conscience that we will win you in the process, and our victory will be a double victory. And I think this is a kind of approach, this is a kind of militant nonviolence that will help us move on into that brighter day and help us creatively face the challenges of this new age. Let me assure you once more that I don't think the problem will ever work itself out. It needs a concerned people of goodwill all over this country with a sort of divine discontent. That are certain technical words within every academic discipline that soon become stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical nomenclature. Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in modern psychology. It is a word maladjusted. Maladjusted. And certainly we all want to avoid being maladjusted, and we all want to live the well-adjusted life in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I must honestly say to you this afternoon, my friends, that there are some things in our nation and in our world which I'm proud to be maladjusted, in which I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust to segregation and discrimination. I never intend to become adjusted to religious bigotry. I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to the few and leave 40 million of our brothers and sisters, white and Negro, around this country somehow caught in an airtight cage of poverty in the midst of an affluent society. I never intend to adjust myself to the madness of militarism and the self-defeating effects of physical violence. But in a day when Sputniks and explorers are dashing through outer space and guided ballistic missiles are carving highways of death through the stratosphere, no nation can win a war. It is no longer a choice between violence and nonviolence. It is either nonviolence or non-existence. And the alternative to disarmament, the alternative to a greater suspension of nuclear tests, the alternative to strengthening the United Nations and thereby disarming the whole world, may well be a civilization plunged into the abyss of annihilation, and our earthly habitat may well be transformed into an inferno such as even the mind of Dante could not imagine. And so it may well be that there is need for a new organization in our world, the International Association for the Advancement of Creative Maladjustment. Men and women who will be as maladjusted as the prophet Amos, who in the midst of the injustices of his day could cry out in words that echo across the centuries, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream." As maladjusted as Abraham Lincoln, who had the vision to see that this nation could not survive half slave and half free. As maladjusted as Thomas Jefferson, who in the midst of an age amazingly adjusted to slavery, could etch across the pages of history words lifted to cosmic proportions. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights, and that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. As maladjusted as Jesus of Nazareth, who could say to the men and women of his generation, "Love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you." Yes, as maladjusted as our Lord in Christ, who could say, "He who lives by the sword will perish by the sword." And through such maladjustment, we will be able to emerge from the bleak and desolate midnight of man's inhumanity to man into the bright and glittering daybreak of freedom and justice. And may I say in conclusion that I still have faith in America, and I believe firmly that somehow we are going to solve this problem. I believe that a coalition of conscience is developing in America, and that somehow we are developing the will to grapple with this problem in a more profound, significant, and determined way. And so I can still join in the singing of our theme song, "We Shall Overcome." I know before the victory is won, some or more will have to get scarred up a bit. Before the victory is won, some more will be thrown into crowded and frustrating jail cells. Before the victory is won, maybe somebody else, like the three civil rights workers in Mississippi and Medgar Evers, will have to face physical death. But if physical death is a price that some must pay to free their white brothers and their children from a permanent psychological death and a permanent death of the spirit, then nothing can be more redemptive. Yes, we shall overcome, because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. We shall overcome because Carlyle is right. No lie can live forever. We shall overcome because William Cullen Bryant is right. Truth crushed earth will rise again. We shall overcome because that is something in the very structure of the cosmos which justifies James Russell Lowell in saying, truth forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne. Yet that scaffold sways the future, and behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. With this faith, we will be able to hew out of the mounting of despair a stone of hope. With this faith, we will be able to transform the jangling discords of our nation into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. With this faith, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children all over this nation, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Catholics and Protestants, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last. Free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last." Thank you.